Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
Lots of talk these days about our streets and whether they're safe or not safe. Another fatality on the roads today up by Lime Ridge Mall. A child hit by a car who sounds like ran out, but nonetheless, another accident on the street. It's created a lot of discussion about whether or not our streets are safe. And it just happens. I mean, it's something that has been planned, but the timing of all this, it happens that tomorrow at Public Works, City Council is going to be talking about a report about complete streets. How do we redesign, or should we redesign streets that would make them safer in the city? Either building new streets that way or fixing up our current streets to reach those levels. I want to bring in Councillor John Paul Danka, Ward 8 Councillor, who some of these streets are in his ward that have been talked about. Councillor, thanks for the time today. I really appreciate it.
Hi, Scott. No problem.
This is the timing of this is, I'll say, interesting. It's timely, certainly, with things that are going on here. Does the timing force the city's hand one way or another, or is this something that happens regardless of what's been happening on the streets lately?
I think the timing is quite tragic, unfortunately. So far in 2022, there have been 14 people killed on Hamilton Roads, 11 pedestrians, two drivers, and a cyclist, and every one of those is a tragedy. I think specifically to myself, the two that really hit home is Jude Strickland and a few years ago, Jake Hetty on the Claremont Access in Ward 8. And it's something that we as a council have been working very hard to address the safety of Hamilton Roads for this entire term, since I've been there anyway. And for the most part, our collision statistics are actually going in the right direction. So total collisions are down, injury collisions are down, pedestrian, cyclist collisions are down. The only one that is trending in the wrong direction is fatalities. And that is, of course, the biggest concern when it comes to Vision Zero.
And so with all the things you said leading up to that last point, is this then just a very unfortunate fluke? Is it a very unfortunate coincidence that everything seems to be heading in the right direction? It's just that we've had a string of terrible accidents. If that's the case, do we change much? Should we change much?
I think there's a number of things that are happening right now all at the same time. So during COVID, we saw in all of Ontario a reduction in fatal and injury collisions down by over 30%. But at the same time, we saw a 10-year high in speeding and aggressive driving. And I think it's that speeding and aggressive driving trend that's kind of carried through to where we are now that is, in part anyway, resulting in more severe collisions with vulnerable road users. There's also, I think, automakers and marketing of vehicles has a role to play, where automakers are building and selling cars and trucks that are much bigger and much less forgiving to anybody that is, on the receiving end of a collision. And they're also marketed with very aggressive promotion that kind of makes it look like it's cool and the thing to do to be that aggressive driver. At the same time, we have penalties for, when you are a driver that is responsible for a very severe collision, the penalties when you go to court are very light. So I think, in total, there's a lot of things that are happening, but as a municipality, we are committed to Vision Zero, and Vision Zero, the basic tenet is that every single severe injury, road collision, and fatality is preventable.
And I think there's a lot of people who would agree with that point. And yet, when we go back to what you just said, and I agree with many of the things you just said, Councillor, I think that, you mentioned Jude Strickland. I mean, there's an example of really we won't call it an accident, and it's an incident that could happen on any stretch of road anywhere in the country, because it wasn't, I don't think, a road flaw that led to that. It was someone not driving properly, as you describe, or driving aggressively or whatever else. And I just wonder how redesigning Hamilton Roads stops some of the things that you're talking about when it is issues with cars and distractions and driving and everything else. How does changing the way our roads are designed get rid of the behaviors?
Well, from an engineering perspective, and as I am a civil engineer, we design road safety for the 85th percentile, meaning that we're designing safety for 85% of road users, but there's 15% that are going to be doing something that is so out of the ordinary that it's virtually impossible to design for safety. But at the same time, we know, and this is proven and engineers are taught this, that the engineered design of the roadway has by far the biggest influence on driver behavior. So what you post the speed limit as, the enforcement that you have, the biggest influence is the physical geometry of the roadway. And I think that's what we're trying to address through the Complete Streets Manual, that we will have a standard approach throughout the entire city when it comes to road safety, that every road in the city will be brought up to be as safe as it possibly could be.
And again, I think you're you know, when you talk about the 85 and the 15, I'm thinking of that situation that was out by the Delta a number of months ago where the car, was it three people killed or four people? I can't remember now, but I think it was. And that one, as I understand it, that was a person racing away from the police and going the wrong way. And you look and you go, I don't know how anybody could build a road that would prevent against someone who is going to do something so egregiously against what the rules and the design was for. Go ahead.
No, I think you're right. And again, you know, when there are severe collisions, there are multiple factors. And that one in particular highlights some of those things that are so extraordinary, where you have a driver that is, at a very high speed, is involved in criminal activity. But at the same time, again, from a Vision Zero perspective, we have to find the root causes from that and what could possibly be done, you know, whether it is the vehicle, the design of the vehicle that they're in, or the physical layout of the road, ways to make vulnerable road users less susceptible to those severe collisions.
Does the city have, or what does the city have in its arsenal that it could... let me back up. You're not going to be able, even with this Complete Streets program that you're going to be presented with, there's no way to change every street overnight. So what can the city do, if anything, to say, all right, even if we think that we need to redesign streets, in the meantime, for deterrence, what does the city have that it can do that could make it less enticing for people to drive in stupid ways?
I think we've already been implementing a lot of the solutions that we know work. So we've added more red light cameras. We have implemented automated speed enforcement, which is very effective in controlling speeding. We're doing collision video analytics at the most dangerous intersections. In Ward 8, we did a ward-wide neighborhood complete streets report, where we're now implementing the findings from that. But I think as a city, when we're talking about a lot of the most severe collisions, they are on arterial roadways. And I think for a long time, arterial roadways have been kind of off limits politically, especially things like Main and King, one-way versus two-way, the discussion about Aberdeen. And I think now that we have the Complete Streets Manual, once that's approved, we will have an official standardized approach to all the roadways in the city, so that it's not just one councillor initiating something, that there's a citywide standard.
Will you be able to satisfy, I won't even say everyone, I know you can't satisfy everyone, that's never been done in the history of city council in any city, but the majority, because drivers are not going to be happy if suddenly they have to crawl through the city and it's impossible to drive through the city. And there is a lobby on the other hand for cyclists who some of them will say, we're not going to be happy until you can ride a bike almost with your eyes closed and not have any risk of being hit by a car. Do you feel confident that somewhere there is a middle ground that will satisfy most people?
Well, I think it's really important that we're not talking about drivers versus pedestrians or drivers versus cyclists, that drivers are road users too. And when we do have dangerous roads, dangerous intersections, they are at risk also. They're at less risk because they're not as vulnerable of a road user, but they are still at risk of very severe injury. And I think, you know, in just in terms of how to please everybody, you know, we did very comprehensive in Ward 8 a review for where to put in traffic safety calming measures. And now that we're actually implementing them, we're getting people that are like, they're too many, and then people that are, they're not enough, and we want them on our street. So it is, you know, trying to find a balance. But again, from an engineer's perspective, we take public safety as paramount, and it is always the most important factor.
Ward 8 Councillor John Paul Danko, always appreciate the time. Thank you for this.
Thanks so much for having me on.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
You are probably aware, you're Canadian, you're probably aware that the Colorado Avalanche won the Stanley Cup a few days ago. And that always brings about massive celebrations. And the Stanley Cup, as we know, makes visits to different players' homes. That's what it does. That's what one of the things that makes it special. Well, that was the plan, at least the other day, that our friend Phil Pritchard from Burlington down the road, the guy with the white gloves who carries and presents the Stanley Cup, the keeper of the cup, Phil was supposed to be taking the cup to Gabe Landeskog's home in Denver so that he and his family could take some photos. However, I guess the street upon which Mr. Landeskog lives is rather tree-covered and leafy, and the addresses were blocked a bit. So when they showed up at Gabe Landeskog's home, turns out it wasn't the right house at all. It was the home belonging to my next guest, Kit Karbler, who was sitting at home, and all of a sudden, well, Kit, let me bring you on the show. Thanks for doing this. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So you're sitting at home just having a lovely afternoon, and a car backs up into your driveway, and suddenly the Stanley Cup is being presented to you.
That's correct. I saw the picture on the Denver Post that morning with Landeskog hoisting it in the air coming out of the airplane. Little did I know it was going to be in our driveway at 6 p.m. that night.
So you look out the door because there's a knock on the door, and all of a sudden the cup is there. What are you thinking?
Well, my husband Dimitri saw a car back into the driveway, and it faces the kitchen window. And he said, "Are we expecting anybody?" I said, "No, we're not." And I was getting ready to watch the evening news, and he was sort of familiar with the case, and he just looked at the hatch when they opened the back of the vehicle, and there was a black box, and he just jokingly said, "Is that the Stanley Cup?" And the guy gave him a thumbs up. And at that time, Phil was about to, well, he came in the house, and of course my dog ran out the door, and so he helped wrangle her because she loves everybody. And sure enough, it was the Stanley Cup, and it was a funny moment when they realized they had the wrong address, because we don't quite live in the same kind of house that they do. So,
well, that's right. I talked to Phil about this yesterday, and he was saying, and you know, I'm sure your house is very lovely, but he said, you know, we're driving up and this looks a little conservative for a hockey player's house. And nonetheless, you know, I guess you and Landeskog, what, your address is off by one digit. Is that right?
That's right.
So when it gets there, then what's the response when they open the trunk and there's the Stanley Cup? I guess they didn't just pack it up and drive away. They said, "You guys want to come and take a look?"
No, not at all. No, not at all. They couldn't have been more gentlemanly. Like, they were happy to show it to us. I said, "Well, can I see it?" And he's like, "Of course." I said, "Well, can I touch it?" He's like, "Sure." And it never occurred to me to take a selfie. I really was flabbergasted, I guess. I think anybody would be. I got to touch it, pick it up, look at it, feel the engraving, and thought for a moment, this is amazing. And, they were nice enough. I probably could have gotten away with more with it, just given the opportunity. I think his buddy's name is Mark, and they couldn't have been nicer. And all I wanted to do is get the trophy on its right direction. So...
Kit, I'm amazed that none of your other neighbors were out there, because I got to think, if you crack open this case and there's anybody else outside, this is going to gather a crowd really fast.
No, it's a quiet neighborhood. That's why they live here. It's quiet, and you know, it's a nice neighborhood. And when he did open the trunk up, they had polished it, and the sun at 6 p.m. was at the right angle, and it literally lit up the kitchen. And Dimitri said, "It looks like a treasure." Well, it was.
Well, you know, around here, and I mean, I can't speak for Denver. I've not lived in Denver. Around here, if somebody showed up with the Stanley Cup in your driveway, it would for most people, it would be the greatest day of their life.
I think it's the same here.
Yeah. Are you a hockey fan, yeah. Kit?
I am now. We watched a lot of the Avs this year because they were so extraordinary. But I will be a lifelong hockey fan from here on out.
How did this story go from that? Because obviously that's a great moment for you guys to have. And I know, as I say, I talked to Phil, I wrote about it for the paper. I talked to Phil yesterday and he, you know, despite the fact that it was a goof up, he loved it. He thought it was a fantastic thing that, you know, you get to share it. He does this with people all the time, but how does it go from you seeing it to this becoming a story that CNN is interviewing you and everyone else in the world seems to be interviewing you?
It is interesting. It started so innocently. It suggests to the power of social media because I did post it on Nextdoor, which is like Facebook, kind of. I'm sure you have Nextdoor in Canada.
Sure, yeah. Yep.
And it's just a neighborhood Facebook sort of thing. And I posted it on there, and I jokingly posted it under Lost and Found. Well, that caught a lot of people's attention. it definitely took off. We had no idea what had just happened after they boxed it up and put it back and drove away down to the proper location, which I directed them to. And it'll be a memory that, you know, we'll talk about for a long time, I'm sure.
Did you know that the captain of the Avalanche lived just a few houses down from you?
You know, I did not know specifically, but I do now. So there are two other Avalanche players that live in the neighborhood as well, in very close proximity. So my neighborhood is called Hilltop, but I think we should change that to Hockey Top.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. But and now that you've put the two and two together, thinking, okay, I know now because I was watching hockey, I saw who that was, and I know that he lives down the street because of this. Now do you look back and go, yeah, of course I've seen him walking by with his dog or when I've been walking my dog or something. Like, have you seen him around town, around your neighborhood?
Well, I don't, because we do walk our dog regularly and we walk past the house regularly, but I can't wait to go ask for a cup of sugar.
Yeah. Well, probably won't come in a cup that nice.
Right. That's right. It was a remarkable experience for all of us.
It is, as I say, it's a fantastic story. And up here, every single person up here would absolutely love to have had happen what you had happened, for just a little boo-boo for the Stanley Cup to end up in their driveway. I guarantee you that. So listen,
well,
really appreciate
it. That's true for here as well, I have to say.
Especially now with the way the team did. Absolutely. Kit Carbler, yeah. Really appreciate you taking a few minutes today. Thanks for talking with us about this.
Totally our pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Something has happened to jingles. Instead of coming up with clever earworms today for products, it seems a lot of companies are just saying, yeah, it's probably easier. Let's take a well-known pop song that we already have out in there. Don't have to pay for it, really, or just for the licensing. And let's just go that route. The Library of American Broadcasting now has an exhibit entitled The Lost Art of Jingle Writing. Juan Manuel Hernandez Chico is a student assistant in special collections in mass media and culture through the University of Maryland Libraries. He joins us now. Juan, thank you for the time today. I really appreciate you doing this.
Hello, Scott. How are you? Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thank you for doing this. I really appreciate coming on because it's such a fun topic. Although, as I'm listening to these, I'm trying to decide, should we be sad that this is a lost art, or should we be thrilled that we're no longer having these earworms burrowing into our heads every time we turn on the TV?
Well, I don't know, but as I like to see it, maybe we still have jingles, but in a different format, if that makes sense. I don't know. I've been thinking about that recently, and maybe meme songs, or I don't know, like what the young people are listening to these days. But I mean, I like them, and I think they are memorable, and I think they serve a purpose, and they have proven to be effective. So,
absolutely, so they have. Absolutely,
me, they have a place in history. Yeah.
Why has it? I want to jump around to a few areas here, but why has it happened that something that apparently was very, very successful form of advertising? Because as I say, I think most people listening knew those. Like instantly, there's a connection Why has it happened that this has fallen out of favor as much?
Well, I'm not completely sure, but you can probably relate it to, I don't know, to trends or to the, because it started in the middle of the 1980s that agents started using like top 40 pop songs, which people, I mean, they were playing on the radio over and over and over, and I guess they served the same purpose in a sense. And probably what a lot of people say about jingles is that they are cheesy, or they are like, I'm trying to find a better word, but that they are like annoying probably. So I guess it just comes down to trends, and but I don't have an answer for that, but yeah, I guess it just comes down to what people want to hear, I guess, or what. Yeah.
The difference, though, is that, like, let's say, take any sort of pop song that is being used for a commercial right now, and there's lots of them, you're right. When I hear that song, I don't necessarily think of the product that I'm seeing it being used to advertise. I think of the pop song, where all the ones that we played and others, when you hear those, there's an instant connection to that product.
Exactly, yes. And I was talking like an hour ago with a friend of mine, and we were discussing that. I mean, even if there are top 40 songs, I couldn't tell you which song played in last year in the latest iPhone commercial or whatever.
Right.
But I can still remember jingles from when I was like 5 or 6 years old that used to play in the radio. And like as you said, it takes your mind back to a product, not only to a. It's not only a song. I mean, it's like a. They represent a product, and they represent basically a product. I'm trying to find a better word, but it all comes down to that. And yeah.
Let's go back to the history of this for a second. Do we know with any kind of certainty, do we really know when this started? When the first brilliant person was who says a song can be, and like a really short song can be so memorable that we can make it connected to a product? When did this start as an advertising method?
Well, we have some songs. If you go back to the early 20th century, we had some songs that were, they were not jingles, but they were songs with product references. Like there's this song called In My Merry Oldsmobile, which was basically a love song about a couple falling in love in an Oldsmobile. But yeah, so that's probably the earliest form of music incorporating references to products that I can think of, or that I found while doing this research. But then if you go a little bit back in time, to the late 19th century, you can find like written advertisements with like, for example, the Sapolio brand soap, and they were using verses to sell a product with like rhymes and in a really creative way. So I guess it was a natural evolution, but the earliest combination of music with like a reference to a product for commercial purposes that I can think of is during the early 20th century with those songs that I was just talking about.
You're a student studying this. I'm not sure you're a musician. You may or may not be. I'm not really sure, but
I'm actually both, but I just got into archives, but my background is in audio engineering, and I also do like music composition and a bunch of other things related.
So maybe you can answer this then. What is it? What is the secret? What is the secret that makes one of these work so well that they stick with us forever? Is it simply repeating it so many times that we hear it a million times and can't forget it? Or is there something else that you can do one of these so perfectly that you only have to hear it two or three or four times and it sticks?
I think where this, like the secret sauce of jingles, it all comes down to melody. And these melodies are so memorable and they're so catchy that even if you hear it one or two times, it will stay with you. And yeah, I think it all comes down to melody, because you can have a mediocre melody and you can repeat it all over and over again, and it might not have the same impact as this song. But what these people did, what these writers did, they were excellent melody writers, and they use that ability to make you want to buy a product, you know. So that would be my answer. Like it all comes down to a good melody, to a catchy melody, because even if you, I mean, a melody is something that you can hum. Even if you have a really complex chord progression, with like a beautiful jazz chord progression, if you have a melody that doesn't stick to people, I mean, it won't sell. So melody is for me the answer to that.
And it's a real irony, isn't it, Juan, that if you are able to write great melodies, think of someone like Paul McCartney, one of the most famous people in the world because of the melodies mm-hmm. that he's able to write. Everybody knows Paul McCartney. I bet you there's not mm-hmm. five people listening right now, maybe not one person now, who could say, oh, I know the name of a great jingle writer. And yet they're obviously incredibly talented.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. And I mean, these people spend the whole of their careers in, like in the shadows of the business, if that makes sense. But they, I mean, they were prolific musicians. They were people who devoted their creativity to crafting these songs. So even if, I mean, I understand that the purpose of these songs was purely commercial, and I get that. But these were people who really knew how to write good and catchy tunes, and I think there's something to be there's something admirable in that. So I mean, I wish more people knew their names, but at least they know their song, so I guess that counts.
Let me ask you another one, as someone who worked sure. who's written music and stuff, and that is, where's the fine line, where's the balance between catchy and memorable and really annoying, but we just have heard it so many times that we're going to remember it? Because somewhere in there, there's some commercials that we've heard and we go, I never want to hear that again as long as I live. But if I remember it, I don't want to ever hear it again. And there's others, I'd like to teach the world to sing. I bet there were a lot of people when we played that little clip who were singing along with it.
Totally. That's a hard question for me to answer. I don't know. I think that's when I mentioned that the secret sauce of jingle writing was the melody, I think that's the mystery of jingle writing, like the fine line, and that's where the success of these famous or prolific writers lies in. I mean, for me, it's like a, because yeah, you can have a good melody and it can sell, but it's also like the combination of things and the combination of factors and the way you let me try to, because this is a really hard question, but it's like the whole concept. So I don't know, for me it's like a magic ingredient, and
yeah, it is.
And
it is.
I don't really have an answer yet, because I mean it's like the yeah, it's that's the magic of how these people became famous. I mean within the advertising world, and
I mean the perfect one, Juan, the perfect. The perfect thing for me when I ask that question is, and it's not a jingle per se, but It's a Small World After All is one of those songs that like it drives people insane. And yet at the same time, it's entirely memorable. Everybody knows it.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
No, go ahead.
I don't know. Sorry. You can go ahead.
So if companies are now getting rid of the jingles, they're not paying, I don't know if it's because they just want to save money, they don't want to have a jingle writer on staff or whatever, and they're going to pop songs, is it just because those are easy, familiar songs already and there's already a belief that people know them, or is it just a way cheaper way of doing it?
I guess they go for that because they think that people know them and that they're trendy. But at the same time, if you look at the numbers, they like the sync licenses that they end up paying a lot of money. So I guess they use them because they think that people relate to them, and I guess they are effective in a way. But like as you said, they remind you of something, but not of the product. So in a year, you won't remember even if you know the song, you won't remember the product. So
right, no,
there's like a contradiction
I'm with
there
you.
Because there's for me there's a contradiction there because even if they're relatable to people and even if they're popular, they will make people will remember the song but not the product. Then what agencies are trying to do is sell a product and not like sell a song that like a random song. So yeah, I guess it's like a double-edged sword at the end of the day.
Yeah, 100%. So do we ever go back? We got to run here, but do you ever expect that we would ever go back? I mean, I guess we don't know for sure, but could you see a day when someone says, you know what, the jingles worked way better. Let's go back to that and see if we can do it. Or are we too fragmented now? Because once upon a time, there were only really three channels on TV, so you were bound to hear mm-hmm. these commercials. Now it's impossible, so just go with something that's easy.
I think, like I said at the beginning, maybe they won't come back in the format that we were used to, but maybe there will be something that serves the same purpose and that has the essence of what the jingle used to be. So, but I really don't think that they will come back, or like that they will be as prevalent as they used to be, but. Maybe, I don't know what the future holds, but maybe like a new format or a new way of selling a product and will come along and that will be like the new incarnation of the jingle. But I mean, I've seen ads recently. I saw one for a pet store that had a traditional jingle and I thought it was pretty effective, but I don't know why. I guess like the people find them funny or silly, or I don't know what word to use, but I think that they're effective and they became what they became because they served the purpose and they did it really well.
I agree. Juan Manuel Hernandez Chico, really very much appreciate the time today. Thanks for talking about this.
Thank you very much, Scott. Have a nice day.
The Scott Radley Show, weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode, and also be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.